At a young age, I was introduced to the world of movie musicals by my mother. From Black and White to Colour, Guys and Dolls, Singing in the Rain, The Wizard of Oz. Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers, Gene Kelly, Doris Day, Judy Garland, Donald O'Connor. As things transpired, my wife Sinead would also turn out to be a fan of musicals, introducing me to the likes of Evita and Les Miserables. As our two children have grown up, musicals became an integral part of our annual cultural life. We've spent many evenings in theatres watching Jesus Christ Superstar, Matilda, West Side Story, Hamilton, Grease, and more. Every time we attend one of these shows and sit in the stalls, my thoughts drift back to a time when I was part of the world on the other side of the footlights, part of the world of the stage musical. It all started with a small notice in the Sunday Independent announcing open auditions for Lionel Bart's Oliver that would be put on by Noel Pearson in the Olympia Theatre in Dublin. I was 13 years old, had never acted, and while my family was a musical one, I had never sung in any formal capacity. But Oliver, starring Jack Wilde, Oliver Reed, Ron Moody, and Shani Wallace, was a movie I loved. So I put my name down, and when my turn came at the auditions held in the Gaiety Theatre, I walked to the middle of the stage and sang as if I had done it many times before, playing to the vast, empty space, projecting my voice to the back seats of the theatre. I'd chosen as my audition song Chris de Burgh's Patricia the Stripper, for the simple reason that it was my favourite song at the time. I had just got to the talky bit of the song where a judge prepares to pass sentence on the licentious woman. But the judge said, "Patricia, or may I say, Delicia, the facts of this case lie before me." When an English voice, the director's, clearly laughing, interrupted, "Where did you get that song from?" "I'm not finished yet," I shouted back, and picked up again. Case dismissed. This girl was in her working clothes. I think that's what clinched my second audition. Eventually, I got the call and was told I was in the show. I would be one of the orphans, and also the understudy for the Artful Dodger, to be played by a young actor called Tom Murphy. Rehearsals for a December 22nd opening began in early November. In addition to the dozen or so other boys, about half of whom were from the famed Billy Barry School of Music and Dance, there were some of the best known acting names in Ireland. John Molloy, Twink, Christopher Casson, Aidan Grinnell, Jonathan Ryan, Barbara Brennan and Charlie Roberts. I became a bit of a rehearsal rat, arriving early or staying late to watch scenes I had no involvement in. By opening night, I knew every line of the show, every song, every dance. I could have played every part. Oliver was an instant hit and the beginning of a remarkable period of my life. Being on stage in front of an audience was truly intoxicating. But there was also the crack with the cast, the magic of being behind stage, in the wings, ropes falling from above like ship's rigging, listening to the muffled sound of an expectant audience taking their seats, actors telling their stories, and singing those great songs, Food, Glorious Food, Consider Yourself, You've Got to Pick a Pocket or Two. And, almost incidentally, I would be handed a small envelope containing £35 every Thursday. After a few weeks, Tom Murphy, the Artful Dodger, became sick, and at short notice I, his understudy, was asked to step into the role for a few days. It was no problem for me. I did not have an ounce of nerves, as I knew the part inside out. As I walked off stage at the end of the first show in which I played the Dodger, I was mildly surprised to be greeted with smiles, hugs, pats on the back. In the end, I would play the part of the Dodger a dozen or so times, and each time was thrilled to hear the aristocratic voice of actor Aidan Grinnell announce, as the lights in the theatre dimmed, "Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. For this evening's performance, the part of the Artful Dodger will be played by Tim Carey. But I do also remember one of the worst moments of my life, which took place during Oliver. It happened during the final scene when Bill Sykes, the villain of the piece, tries escaping by climbing a huge ladder, but is shot and killed. On this night, for some reason, I decided to stand in a different place than I normally did. In doing so, without being aware of it, I transformed myself from an actor taking part in the show into a spectator watching it. When I saw some of the cast turn to me with imploring expressions, then pleading, then panicked, I was confused. What was the problem? Then it dawned on me. I had a line in this scene, one of the most crucial lines in the play. I was to point at the disappearing Sykes and cry out, "There he is!" A policeman shoots, Sykes is hit, he falls to his death, and everyone lives happily ever after. Jolted back into the role of actor by my colleagues, I ran to my normal spot, began to point upwards, and was about to shout my line when two other actors took matters into their own hands and did the same thing. Three characters suddenly shouting the same line. It was not good. To this day, I distinctly remember one of the leads saying to me as we walked off stage, "None out of ten, Tim. None out of ten." As the weeks passed, audiences became smaller and smaller, and we checked the board by the stage door for the dreaded notice. And then, there it was. The last performance of Oliver will take place on March 21st. During the last encore, 3 months after our first performance, I think everyone on stage had tears streaming down their faces. That night, the curtain did not come down on just a show. It came down on an intense, all-consuming time in my life. Some of the boys I shared those months with stayed in show business. I sometimes see their names in credits. One of them went on to become a significant actor. Tom Murphy, the Artful Dodger, the boy I understudied for, would win a Tony Award for his Broadway performance in The Beauty Queen of Lean Ann, and memorably played the co-lead in the movie Adam and Paul about two Dublin drug addicts. Sadly, Tom died tragically young, and Irish acting lost one of its finest talents. I did take part in another professional production shortly after Oliver. It was John B. Keane's Many Young Men of 20, which ran in the Olympia and the Cork Opera House. But that was it. While I enjoyed taking part in the shows, deep down, I don't think I really wanted to be an actor. Indeed, my only subsequent acting outings were bit parts in school plays. And, to be honest, I don't think I was very good. Still, every time I go to a musical with my family, I see myself on the stage. And from that seat in the stalls, I know what it is to look through the dazzle of the lights at the vague outlines of people. Know what it is to receive that applause. And know what it is to experience the unique silence of a theatre after the audience have left, and then to finally exit by the stage door.
In this life, one thing counts in the bank, large amounts. I'm afraid these don't grow on trees. You got to pick a pocket or two. You got to pick a pocket or two, boys.
You got to pick a pocket or two.
For me, Christmas wouldn't feel like Christmas without Gone with the Wind. On a regular rollout with Sky Cinema greats for the festive season, this American Civil War epic endures as one of the most popular films of all time. Winner of 8 Oscars, it would challenge a Netflix box set for drama and suspense. Feeling longer than the Civil War itself, you've scoffed a whole tub of roses and scarlet still hasn't uttered. After all, tomorrow is another day. Modifying Margaret Mitchell's 1,000-page masterpiece into a film to be viewed at one sitting was a formidable feat. Though Mitchell's Pulitzer-winning grand opus is without doubt an ode to the Old South, it may also be regarded as a narrative of an Irish diaspora. Scarlett's survivalist declaration that she'll never be hungry again echoes the voices of thousands of Irish arriving in America in the 19th century. Her character is based on Mitchell's maternal grandmother, the tenacious Annie Fitzgerald. Annie's father had emigrated from Tipperary at the turn of the 19th century to escape the aftermath of the 1798 rebellion. Toiling tirelessly, he built from nothing a large plantation and soon metamorphosed into a rich southern slave owner. Scarlett's father, Gerald O'Hara's character, is based on him. The novel describes Gerald having the brogue still heavy on his tongue, despite 40 years in America. Clever and ambitious, he was not schooled. The only Latin he knew, Mitchell writes, was the responses to the Mass. The only poetry, that of Moore. The only music, the songs of Ireland. Tara is central in defining Gerald's character. It is not the graft of a yeoman, but the labour of a poor Irish bog trotter with an inbred lust for land. In the film, Gerald insists that the land is the only thing in the world worth working for, worth fighting for, worth dying for, because it's the only thing that lasts. He tells Scarlett, "It will come to you, this love of the land. There's no getting away from it if you're Irish." Mitchell spent summers on the old plantation with her grandmother and the Fitzgerald aunts. They delighted in telling stories of the High Kings of Tara, of Tone and Emmet. They sang Moore's ballads and recited the poems of James Clarence Mangan. Once, when Mitchell was presented with a book of Mangan's poems, she admitted to never having read them, though she could, from memory, recite Dark Rosaline, O Hussey's Ode to the Maguire, and others. It is possible, then, that the title, Gone with the Wind, although often said to reference another poem by Ernest Dowson, may actually owe something to Mangan's poem, Solomon, where is thy throne? It is gone in the wind. Babylon, where is thy might? It is gone in the wind. Ironically, Mitchell saw nothing of the oppressed becoming the oppressor in the O'Hara story. Gone with the Wind reminds us of America's long road of racial progress. While the film deletes all the book's references to the Ku Klux Klan and the N-word, it would have us believe that slaves like Mammy and Prissy willingly accepted their inferior lot, that they were ever jolly and well-treated and diligently loyal to their benevolent owners. Big Sam leaves Tara only when instructed to do so. But in real life, many slaves abandoned their masters at the first opportunity. They fled to the north or to fight in the war. The film covertly blames their post-war plight on their emancipation. They were slaves because they couldn't function independently, it suggests. The film's premiere in Atlanta took place shortly before Christmas in 1939. President Jimmy Carter recalled it as the biggest event to happen in his lifetime. The governor proclaimed a public holiday, Confederate flags flew, and bands marched to the strains of Dixie. Bracing the freezing cold, hundreds of thousands of fans, dressed in period attire, thronged the streets to welcome the Hollywood stars. In segregated Georgia, some, however, were more welcome than others. Eager cheers hailed Clark Gable and Vivian Leigh, while black cast members, including Hattie McDaniel, were glaringly absent. Hattie, whose parents were former slaves and whose father fought in the Civil War, would later win an Oscar for her portrayal of Mammy, the first for a black actor. She famously said that she would rather earn $700 a week for playing a maid than $7 for being one. Vanderbilts, Astors, Rockefellers, Morgans and governors of what used to be the Confederacy mixed with any class of white Southerner who could afford the ticket. Not black Southerners, though. They were again forced to go north, this time to view the film. You regard 1939 as a different world, removed from yours by 80 years of reformist enlightenment. The film's politics appall you, and you don't forget this even as the characters draw you in. They undertake quests, survive adversity, find and lose love, established storytelling ploys as old as Eve. You start watching, dig into the roses, and you can't stop.
I have walked across frozen over lakes in remote Canadian forests and surveyed landscapes of unbroken snow in Arctic conditions in Scandinavia. But ask me for my coldest winter memory, and one place and date spring to mind. Finglas Park, 7:15 a.m. on December 27, 1978. There are no clouds in an ink-black sky. The rest of the world sleeps amid sparkling frost that turns the pavement into a treacherous, virtually impassable skating rink. I am a 19-year-old factory hand, pulling my coat tight, trying to keep my balance by gripping onto walls. A car slides past El McKee Road, the driver's scared face peering out from a small circle of windscreen which he has hacked clear of ice. I turn the corner onto Jamestown Road and become part of a procession of factory workers walking in silence because it is too cold and early to shout greetings as we enter the Unidur Industrial Complex gates to return to work the morning after St. Stephen's Day. At 7:28, I punch in my time card at the Alderkin Welding Rod Factory. Normally, there are clamouring voices and a residue of warmth as the night shift winds down the machines for the morning shift to take over in that factory which operated three shifts around the clock. But that morning, we are the first shift back after the brief Christmas break. An eerie silence haunts the factory. It seems colder in there than the frozen streets outside, a Siberian chill cutting into our bones as you blow on our fingers and wait for the hooter. I remember little about the rest of that shift when the usual racket of machinery resumes, men swapping jokes while deftly lifting trays of welding rods from the conveyor belt. I just remember the clarity of dawn when it finally lightened the grimy skylights. In the fairy tale of Sleeping Beauty, I am not sure what the enchanted castle looked like which lay undisturbed, but I suspect it would bear an uncanny resemblance to many offices and public buildings across Ireland that now go into hibernation between Christmas and New Year's Day. Not every worker enjoys generous Christmas breaks. Just ask any supermarket cashier or department store worker summoned back for the Christmas sales. But many workplaces now enter a week-long midwinter limbo when, as Lord Byron wrote, the heart must pause to breathe and love itself have rest. Back in 1978, it was only 4 years since New Year's Day became a statutory bank holiday. I was the youngest worker among men twice and three times my age who all looked out for me in different ways, but who took no prisoners and suffered no fools. Early in my time, there was a work to rule. Then industrial peace broke out and I discovered that, while I had previously found a walk hard, my crew had been taking life easy. Soon they began to walk against the clock for bonus payments at a speed that left me shattered. That year, my crew also walked the night shift before the Christmas Eve shutdown. I remember whiskey smuggled in, and workers who'd been drinking in pubs before our shift breaking into tomfoolery to inject Christmas cheer into a long shift. But nobody tried to be cheerful on our first morning back after Christmas. When we emerged, the onset of dusk guaranteed another sharp frost. But we weren't the only people walking that week. When I got home, the postman had delivered a letter delayed in the Christmas rush. It told me my application for a job as a library assistant was successful. In the new year, I would leave behind those factory gates. I broke this news to my workmates later that week when we gathered in a local pub for a send-off party for an English factory hand returning to Birmingham. It was a wild, hilarious night, the first time I felt fully accepted among the factory hands. In early January, I gave in my notice. Every man there wished me well. Someone suggested we all meet up in that same pub the next Saturday for my send-off. On the Saturday, I arrived early. 2 hours passed before I realised nobody was coming. I was just a kid who never truly earned my spurs in that factory. Those grown men meant no unkindness, but they had already forgotten about me, immersed in their own worlds. It was the last valuable lesson in the only university I ever attended. But I remember them and my 19-year-old self whenever I watched the thousands of workers with no long Christmas break return to walk through otherwise empty streets, the wage earners for whom there is no respite in the days between Christmas and New Year.
I hear something saying,
sound of the men working on the chain gang.
No other song evokes such bittersweet nostalgia as Auld Lang Syne, gifted to the world by Robbie Burns in 1788, when he embellished a 1588 ballad. Its theme of "Let's drink to good days gone by" is an appropriate toast to a new year, as the happenings in the old year become slowly and surely reduced to a collection of stories. The sacred ritual of standing in a circle and holding hands as it is sung never fails to give me both a warm sense of belonging and a lump of sadness in my throat. Joan Baez is closest to the mark when she sings that memories bring both diamonds and rust. Auld Lang Syne is not the only Pied Piper that leads me into a cascade of memories. When I was rooting out the Christmas decorations in the attic, a forgotten bag of musty clothes surfaced. The caress of a moth's wings on my cheek when I open the bag prompts me to peg the clothes out in the cold Atlantic breeze to air. And then, helpless, off I go into what Marcel Proust called the immense palace of memory. His epic 7-volume Remembrance of Things Past came out of the moment his entire childhood rushed into his memory as he dipped his cake in linden tea. My palace doesn't seem as orderly as Proust's. For me, my bag of musty clothes makes one memory spring another in a muddle of unruly emotions. The clothes mostly date from the 7 years of my life between the age of 18 and 25. The 1972 purple velvet caftan brings me back to those heady, patchouli-scented student days in Belfast. the 1973 maxi dress from Portobello Market in London, to feeling invisible as a wardsmaid scrubbing hospital floors in Tooting. A handwritten receipt from the Basement Boutique in Dublin for £19.99, the balance of the total cost of £24.99, falls out of a demure white cotton maxi dress. This dress contains a swirl of happy memories of how, at 20, I clunked up the aisle in my white wooden clogs to marry my love. The flowery smock reminds me of the continuing of that happiness and my awe when first one and then a second tiny new person came to meet us. The clothes memory map jumps then to 1985 with a long floaty skirt I wore and wore when we, with those two little girls, made a 3-month camper van trip through Eastern Europe, then still behind the Iron Curtain, and through Turkey to Iraq. The skirt calls to mind the pared-back lightness of our self-contained world with the thrill of the unknown each day. Oh, the memories are all so beguiling, but what am I actually remembering? I always thought memories were static, like flies trapped in amber, but now the neuroscientists tell us they change spontaneously over time, depending on how, when, and where we recall them. Our memories are fickle. What we remember is not necessarily the way it was, but our preferred version of the past. In each new year, we are suspended briefly between the past and the future, between heartbreaking goodbyes and the hope of heartwarming hellos. It is in this space that Auld Lang Syne has become a collective memory map to round off the old year before facing into the new. Why, though, have I kept those clothes for so long? Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? The clothes are to me what the song is and what those soggy cake crumbs were to Proust, a portal into a world of memories, even if with time those memories are becoming cloudy. To those who come after me, my memory portal will be just a bag of musty vintage clothes. For the moths of this new year, however, they're a good dinner. I treat my memories to a moth-proof bag before I return them to their slumbers.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and days of old lang syne?
If William Morris believed that the most important production of art was a beautiful book, I hold that belief too. When I heard Little Women was coming to the big screen, I treated myself to a collector's copy. Produced by Puffin, this special edition of Louisa May Alcott's classic is inspired by the Victoria and Albert Museum's collection of the work of William Morris, creator and craftsman. The purple hardback is designed with one of his iconic patterns featuring the larkspur. Liz Catchpole, a contemporary illustrator, adapted the backdrop with her sketch of Joe, narrator of the March family. Larkspur, a symbol of opportunity, celebration, protection and achievement, was an appropriate flower to envelop this novel, first published in 1868. When I was a child, this was the first story I read, over and over until I almost knew it by heart. On days left to myself, I loved rummaging in the large trunk left in our attic room, a space full of the lure of abandoned things. The trunk contained books, letters, school journals, exercise copies, and when I hauled that lid above my head, the smell of aging paper stirred my curiosity. Still fairly new to reading, I instantly recognised my own Marmee's hand on a book covered with homemade waxed paper, and I deciphered her carefully written capitals on the spine, Little Women. This tattered version had lost its original cover long before I was born, and with it, its first few pages. What remained had yellow splotches and uneven edges, but the matte, dense pages with their elegant font maintained my attention. Eagerly reading these disintegrating pages, I walked in the shoes of each of these March girls through their various stages of youth. As the youngest of my family, I could be the demanding Amy, attention-seeking and self-centred, but my short curls and ordinary nose were never going to attract the admiring looks that Amy March did. Envious of her beauty, I salivated as my imagination dropped a pickled lime, whatever that was, into my mouth. On days when good behaviour seemed appropriate, I was the responsible and practical Meg March. My mother's cooking transformed our yellow custard into blancmange and blackcurrant jam into currant jelly. As she lined up her rhubarb tarts for baking, I'd imagine my mother as Mrs. Brooke in March's kitchen with aproned Lottie as she cranked open the latch of their waiting hot oven to welcome our tarts. During episodes of childhood illnesses like measles, mumps and my version of Teutonic phlegm, I tried to emulate the patient Beth. I envisaged her pale, sickly face in the mirror, but that's where the similarity ended, as I could never be the quiet and accepting child. Beth's sweet demeanour was more than I could ever aspire to, and those pages in the chapter, Dark Days, are probably still damp with the sympathetic tears I shed every time I read it. And then there was Jo, but I'll come to her. As with the four sisters, plays, concerts and creating worlds became part of my childhood too. Our parked car in the yard was decorated with ribbons and cans as I married my local Laurie and we took off on our imaginary honeymoon. A group of us dressed up as nuns in our vignette of Pilgrim's Progress and visited the local graves of forgotten souls. And just as Louisa May Alcott wrote of her own youth, I had a pleasant time with my mind, for it was happy. Throughout the years, it was the sense of the family unit and their warmth that stayed with me. There's a sincerity, a purity of feeling that comes through this book Louisa May Alcott created in just 6 weeks. It reminds me of my own home in rural Roscommon, where my parents often demonstrated many acts of selfless tenderness. Like Jo, I was ambitious and equally convinced that my quest for truth and all things good was achievable, and to this day it is her resilience, her love of stories, her pen and paper to hand, and her constant tendency to analyse the world that I feel most empathy with. Her personality seems to be the right fit, thorny, high-spirited and sometimes impulsive. I, too, find myself dropping tears one minute and laughing the next. She cajoles me to dare with her, to overcome our unfortunate gaffes in life, to step into her shoes and the boundless realms of imagination. And carrying that quest in my heart a half century on from first meeting Meg, Jo, Beth and Amy, reading this new edition has me anticipating with huge delight our own Saoirse Ronan on screen in the latest Little Women, which has just opened in cinemas around the country. As she steps into Jo's shoes, I'll walk each moment with her. I wonder if we share the same shoe size.